Hey, Jake here, and we got to pay some bills over here at 3 Point Perspective podcast. So this episode is sponsored by svslearn.com. It's an online learning platform we created because we all taught at art schools and realized you could get the same level of education without the enormous price tag. With courses from the three of us and dozens of other published illustrators, SVS Learn is the best way to get an art school education at your own pace and for a fraction of the cost. Start your free 30-day trial today at svslearn.com/3point. Hello, everybody. Welcome to 3 Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And Will Terry couldn't join us today. He is on assignment. So because today we are interviewing Amy Kibuishi, the author, illustrator of The Rima Chronicles, which is a new book that comes out today, graphic novel series. It's book one. And Lee, this was an incredible interview. I learned some things. There was like some real good nuggets that she shared with us there. So what'd you think?
She knows her process for sure. And she cares about story so much. It's just cool because she... what Jake and I were just talking about, how is each illustrator that we're interviewing the same? How are they different? And for her, it's not really about, okay, oh, I'm an illustrator. It's, she's got these stories like bottled up inside of her and she has to get them out. That was like the big takeaway that I got from the whole thing, is that she'll be upset if this story didn't get out. She's not trying to be illustrator of the year, even though she's a great illustrator. She's just got these stories and there's a lot of meaning there. They mean a lot to her, and then they mean a lot to her audience. I think she's got a healthy following too, you know?
Well, and that's the point too, is she, it's not so much that she selfishly just, I want to do it because it means so much to me, but she feels almost called, like this story could help others. Cause it's a story that comes out of a time of turmoil in her life. And it was her way of dealing with it. And she's like, if this could help me, then how could it not help others? You know, how could it not be a source of healing for others? So I thought that was cool. A couple of things that stuck out to me. I took some notes while we were listening or talking to her. Is this process of always making something, like always contributing and putting something out there, and not just being too content to let it exist, you know, on the sideline or in the background, but to actually put it out and share it with people and give it to people. I think that's a key to like the things actually being made and her success.
Yeah. And if you start to break that down a little bit more, she's good about using what was available at the time and for how far the story was developed. You know, if it was like a couple pages, that's a web comic, and then that becomes a zine or something, and then that becomes, it gets written as a novel, then it changes form, and then it gets turned into a graphic novel. Eventually, you're holding this big book, and you know, if you just buy it from the bookstore, it's just so funny. I talk about this a little bit in the interview, but like if you buy it, go into a bookstore or a library, each thing you're holding is years for somebody. And she cultivated this over years, but she did it in a way that made sense for each stage. And she's kind of the long-term illustrator, in my opinion. She's like a little bit at a time, and all of a sudden you got the, you know, Great Wall of China. You know,
right. Right. Yeah, for sure. A couple other things I thought was cool is, and this is a thing that we see keep popping up with these illustrators we interview, but that's early on having a group of like peers that challenge you and inspire you and sort of follow you along. Like you guys follow each other along through your careers. So that was interesting. She ended up marrying one of them. You know, having a family. I love that she balances illustration with motherhood.
And does it pretty well. She didn't seem frantic. She's definitely leaning in to both of them, the good parts of being a mom and then the good parts of being an illustrator. She's got it kind of figured out in a, you know, it's not easy to figure that stuff out. I sure don't have it figured out.
And to that, make sure you pay attention in this interview, how she is able, like how she manages her time on the project that she's working on. I thought that was really cool too.
Yeah. Big project, so, long-term project. And she just moved the thing forward and here we go. It's launching today. And, I can't wait to see it. We've seen a PDF one, but there's a difference when you're holding something.
Yeah. All right. Should we go to the interview?
Let's play it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Amy, for joining us. Tell us where we're reaching you from and what you've been up to.
Oh man. Well, we live in Washington State. It's very, green here. And right now it's very dark because it's right in the middle of winter time. We just had a whole ton of snow here and just the roads were iced over and everything. But it was really beautiful. But that aside, I'm just working on book two of the Rima Chronicles and just kind of chugging along as best as I can. And really nervous about the release of book one, but it's going to be fine.
I think it's going to be good. This episode is actually airing on your release date, so hopefully this day's going good for you. We'll see.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome.
I appreciate you sending over the the advanced PDF of it because I got a chance to flip through it. I didn't finish reading it, but it's really cool just to see this whole thing fleshed out because I know you've been working on it for a long time. I'm curious what led to this day of a graphic novel coming out. Like, where did this start and how did you get to this point?
It's a pretty long story. Do you want the long version or the short version?
Give us the short version and then let's
unpack it where we need to.
Yeah.
Okay. Short version is I've been working on this book since I was 13. Was it 12 or 13? Around that time, I had a dream. My family was kind of homeless technically at the time. And I think I was very stressed out. And when I woke up from this dream, I just wanted to go back there. So, the Rima Chronicles and development of the world has always been about finding a home, finding that thing that makes you feel like this is where I belong, Mm-hmm. And it's tied into so many different things. Long story short, I just kept working on it as sort of a creative playground as I got older and studied cartooning at School of Visual Arts and everything. I just kept working on this story. It was an obsession of mine to figure it out, Mm-hmm. And I wrote it as a novel. And during that phase, which lasted 7 years where I just wrote the story as a novel instead of a comic book, it all came together as a novel. And then I adapted it into a comic book and it got picked up by Graphics. And this is
the whole thing as a standalone novel, no images.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a very intuitive person. So if I get an intuition that my story, it sounds so cheesy, but if my characters are telling me, hey, you got to write this as a novel now, I don't question it. I just kind of well, I guess I'm not a cartoonist anymore. And I made this big announcement online because I had a bit of a following for it. Back then it was called Riemann Mythology. And that was a web comic, came out back in 2003. And it had a pretty good size audience. And some of those people are still here waiting to read this final version. So thank you to you, whoever you are out there that's still sticking around. But yeah, I think I kind of disappointed some people that were really interested in my work because I was I'm just going to write now. I'm a writer now. And
that but is in so retrospect, important. And that's amazing that you were able to pull that off and just decide that and then actually follow. I could think of a million people who would make that decision and not follow through.
Yeah, I like to take things all the way and then change my mind if I need to. I'm a bit stubborn like that. So I wanted to get to the point where I felt like if I worked on it just a little more, I could actually get it published and I would be able to have a career that way. Mm-hmm. But the need for graphic novels is so great right now. It just seemed kind of and there's not that many people that can actually do it and do it at such a level where I think, and this is me, I guess, tooting my own horn at such a level where your storytelling ability makes it easy to read, Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I can do that. And there's such a need. So who am I to say no, you should read the novel version. There's so many good writers out there. But I was just it should be a graphic novel. And Kazoo, of course, my husband, the author of Amulet, he's just over my shoulder the entire time I was writing the novel. And was it should be a graphic novel. Do not deny yourself, Amy. You are a cartoonist. And I'm go away.
I get it, though, because, and I don't know if there were other factors influencing it, but Lee and I were just looking at this together and we're like, graphic novels are so much work. It's so much drawing that some, you know, for a writer to just say, you know, a swarm of bees flew in through the window is one sentence. But for a graphic novelist to draw that, now you're drawing 100 bees, you know?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. And I'm so glad I took that journey to be a writer, because actually it all evens out in the end. Because think about it took me 7 years to write the novel version. And at that point, it would still need another 4 years of polish before it could probably get published, you know, the time that I decided to switch over. And it took me 4 years to do this, you know, the graphic novel version of Realm of the Blue Mist. And it's all the same, because when you're writing, you can't just say there is a swarm of bees. It has to flow, and you have to have the right grammar and the right poetry and the timing. Otherwise, people will put the book down. So it's kind of similar in that the aesthetic of the writing matters, just like the aesthetic of the drawing matters. Does it fit your book and all that stuff in the storyline? So I hear that a lot, where people like, on both sides, where like a novelist would be like, oh, I can see why you would want to do it as a comic book, because then you could just draw the thing instead of having to describe everything, you know? And then when I talk to comic artists, they're just like, oh, I can see why you want to write it. You can just say that instead of having to draw everything. And it's like, the reality is there's no way around the work. If you want to, if you want to express
your idea. I think the writing is harder. I mean, I've got to say, because I'm stuck on some stories I've been bouncing around for years, and I just can't seem to pull out the right way that it needs to flow. It's not the drawing. And once I got the writing, the drawing's easy, but I don't know. The writing, well, which one's easier for you? Do you have one that you kind of favor, or are they truly even at this point?
Well, if you read my writing, you would definitely be like, oh no, it's not even at all. You're a much better artist than a writer. My writing is pretty wooden. It's almost like script-like, like reading a screenplay, but formatted like a novel, which is a nightmare. But I'm getting there though. I'm becoming a better writer, and it's something I'm still working on. But it's I wouldn't say one's easier for me than the other. You're probably, I think I was in your shoes with this story, but in particular for like years, you know, pretty much most of my life, I was stuck on the writing of the story of Rima for like more than a decade. And when I finally figured out what I had to do, it was like unplugging a cork and everything flowed after that. But until I got to that point, it was always a struggle. And I always felt like I didn't know what I was doing, and the confidence issues. And now I know you just need to push a little bit farther and hang on to it just a little bit more, one more draft. You'll get there, and you'll know it when you get there. But until you do, it's going to seem like it's not working. And
interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of a leap of faith type of thing. You just got to believe and keep digging.
I want to go back to 13-year-old Amy has the dream. What happened between 13 and art school? Like, was what were you doing as like a youth, you know, with this, or were you even drawing at all, or
what? Yeah, I was drawing a ton. And in fact, I was looking through some of my old stuff that we have in storage, and I have like sketchbooks upon sketchbooks just filled with like, I mean, they were really good for my age. Like if I saw an 11-year-old doing as much drawing as well as they were, I'd be like, maybe they have some mental issues. They should go get that checked out. Like, right. It was like an obsession. And it wasn't just Rima. It was like all kinds of worlds. I had all these worlds that I was trying to develop, and all these people that populated the worlds that I was obsessed with. But definitely the Rima world was the one that I always was going back to. And I did like, I don't know what to call it, like a novella. It started as a novella when I was after, you know, they had that dream. I didn't draw it as a comic, or I didn't even draw the characters at all. I just started writing it. I had this like, you know, it was called a Star Writer 2000 or something. It was like this, like a word processor machine. And I would just sit there and type it all out. I think I did maybe like 200 pages of that. And my, the head of the English department at my high school saw it, and she was just like, you should be published. So she tried to walk me through the publishing process back then. I think it was more her project than mine. And we prepared it for, you know, query letters and everything, submissions to send out to publishers at the time. And they all came back. Even back then, they were like, you know, you should turn this into a comic book. There must just be something about my writing. So I was just like, oh, I guess so. But I shared it with one friend. Shout out to Kim Hagel. She will be very excited about this because she's always been so supportive on my social media. But she was a friend who in high school who read it, and she always was like, "Oh my gosh, what happens next to Philip? You know, the main guy, and what happens mm-hmm. to Tabby?" And that kind of strung me along. Yeah. And then when I went to art school, I didn't really think of Rima. I think I was too busy trying to impress everybody with my drawing skills or whatever, you know, like mm-hmm. you do in college, where like, yeah, I know how to draw an arm with muscles. But like, I joined, do you know Becky Cloonan by any mm-hmm. chance? Yeah. So she was a friend of a friend. And there was a group of girls, and they had this club called Estrogis. I don't know if I should talk about this because she's probably kind of embarrassed about it. But anyway, they had a club that they made at a school of visual arts where I went to college called the S&M Club, which stood for Shoujo Manga. You know, they were like trying to be cheeky about it. So I was like, I like manga. You know, I love Sailor Moon and Rumiko Takahashi. So I was like, I'll go check this out. And that's where I met one of my best friends. Her name is Jennifer Quick, mm-hmm. currently Jennifer Strombeck. And she's like a really... prolific artist. She doesn't mm-hmm. have much published, but her love for the craft of storytelling and comics is so palpable. When you're around her, you just get excited about drawing. And, you know, she took a look at, I had this really cheesy drawing of Philip, and she was just like, it looks like you really like that character, Amy. Why don't you turn that into a comic and then make it into a zine, and you come with me and Becky to anime conventions and we'll sell it at the tables. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. And it did pretty well. You know, like people kept coming back, you know, because I would travel to the different anime cons with Jen and Becky and with yeah. my zine. And it was a really fun time. But that was kind of the start of that.
How big was the zine? How many pages?
It was like 32 pages. Mm-hmm. In one zine, and that included things like character profiles and maps and like, you know, all the extras, bonus material.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was so fun. Like we would all sit together in their like junky apartment in Queens, and we would be like drawing on the floor, drawing our comic pages, and see like how many people, like how many pages could you ink? Like, oh, I did 7 today. I'm like, that's it. I did 10. It's like, oh, you're so fast. Oh my God, Becky, you know, like it was like a sort of friendly competition thing to get us all, yeah, upgrade our skills. It was really fun.
That's cool. So did you, and you got it done at like a copy shop or something, or was it more of a professional job? Yep,
good old Kinko's.
Okay.
No, not professional at all. It's so expensive to do it that way too, as college students. It's just like, man, to hand make your own zines. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's super cool.
That's interesting because we talked with Katya Chen a couple weeks ago, and she was my little group like you're talking about. And so we were doing sort of the same thing. And so it's interesting that these little groups are happening everywhere at every school. And it's kind of the mm-hmm. sort of the shot in the arm to stay in it and get the feedback and, I don't know, safe space to create. How important was it for you to have this little group? Do you think you would have ended up where you did without that group to kind of facilitate this work and this time?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not like a god or anything. I can't reverse time and see what would have happened. I mean, who knows? It is what it is. But I mean, having that group of friends, I'd say, was the biggest benefit of going to college at all. You know, I learned a lot at SVA. It was actually a really great education. But, you know, just college is so expensive right now. And it's hard for me to say, yeah, you should definitely go to college because there you'll meet some people that you can relate to and work together.
Well, it's my like big push is like meet some people. It doesn't have to be through college, but the connection with peers and pushing each other to create seems to be this common thread of success that I'm now starting to see now that we're doing these interviews, talking mm-hmm. to other artists and stuff. That seems to be this common history of a moment where it sort of pushes you past learning technique and all that stuff and making things that mean something.
Yeah, well, just for sure.
Yeah, just the fact that it's like, oh, I inked 7 pages. No, I inked 10 pages. Like, the reason she inked 10 pages is because you were sitting there inking 7 pages, right? So it's like, it's this healthy, like, you realize what's possible by seeing what the person next to you is doing.
Yeah, that creative energy is really important. And I mean, what we do as artists is just so highly specific and specialized. Mm-hmm. Like where I grew up in Rochester, New York, there really wasn't anybody around me that was into anime or or like draw, let alone drawing like anime styled stuff, or even thinking about like nobody knew what Totoro was or anything. And like, mm-hmm. it was just me. So when I went to School of Visual Arts and I met Jen and Becky, it was just, yeah, it really opened up my creative visions and my ambitions and stuff. And yeah, I definitely wouldn't be doing that without them. So
post art school, you like, what happened at the end of art school, and how did you make that jump from I went to art school and now I'm whatever I am?
Well, I just woke up, Jake, and it was there, and there Scholastic was knocking at my door. No. Well, gosh, there's so much stuff that happened, as you know, because of Flight Comics and things mm-hmm. like that. But before Flight Comics, it's funny. Oh, my God. But it's a reality of the past. So at the time, you know, manga inspired work was starting to be noticed because mm-hmm. there were so many kids coming out of college that were drawing manga inspired work like me and many others. Mm-hmm. So there was this magazine called Amerimanga, the worst name ever.
I remember that.
But it was I forgot the name, IC Press or something like that. But it was just a horribly run operation. But they did it, and they took my Rima and Mythology zines and printed it there. So that was my first printing in anything published that's not a zine. And surprisingly, people discovered it through that. So I don't know what their distribution was, but it was enough to get some new readers. And I was working at Barnes & Noble at the time as that was happening, you know. But I was so excited just to see it in print. I didn't care that it was called Amerimanga. I was like, yay.
That's a huge win, though.
It was a huge win. And, you know, and that kind of fell under, of course, because it's just it's so much work to run a publishing anything. And I don't, mm-hmm. I think they were in over their head. So after that, I threw the comic book online, and that's when it turned into a web comic, and that did pretty well. Mm-hmm. I had a forum and everything that I had to moderate with lots of discussions, and it was really fun. That's when go ahead.
What year was that? Did it become a webcomic?
It was like 2003.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that is like prime time for a webcomic because there's no social media yet.
Oh man, it was great. I feel really bad now.
Blog readers, I think, at some point. Is that how, was it RSS feed comic, or are you just uploading it?
That was before RSS feed.
Oh, wow.
RSS feed wasn't even a thing. So you had a website. I used Front Page, Microsoft Front Page, to build my website. And you just had to pay for a host, and then you'd upload your HTML files, you know, and you had to do it that way. So I would hand code each and every page with the back and forth arrows and everything like that.
Right.
And then there was be a link to the BBS forums, you know, that I had. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty hands-on. That was when people did things called link exchanges. I don't know if they still do those, where you made like a little graphic. Yeah. And then it would be like, for example, go read the book or the comic book Copper, the web comic Copper. And it had a little picture of Fred and Copper on there. And then you'd click it and it would go to the boltcity.com website where Copper would be featured, this comic book. And that's the same time that I first met Kazuki Buishi, actually, too. And I mention him a lot because he had such a huge impact on me. Obviously, we're married now, but I mean, aside from our relationship, he's just such an amazing editor, and he has such a wealth of knowledge. And our relationship and his guidance really helped me get to where I am right now, big time. I definitely would not be published right now, or even still doing this book, this story, if it wasn't for his guidance and encouragement the entire time. But it started almost being like, oh, your work is amazing, Amy. Oh, you should go on Flight Comics. It's the thing I'm doing. And, you know, speaking of Katya Chen, she was part of that too. And and you too, Jake. And it was just sort of like that whole event. I mean, that's a whole other podcast talking about Flight Comics.
Right.
It's an amazing time.
There needs to be a definitive oral history of the Flight Comics.
Yeah. Scene,
like the whole thing. That would be cool.
I mean, especially in retrospect, so many artists that were participating in that anthology moved on to do great things, whether in film or in books. I mean, it's almost a one-to-one, like every single one went on to do something, you know?
Right.
It's pretty amazing.
It really was an incredible group of people. And I think Scott McCloud wrote the intro to it. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
But he's like, hear me out. you know, someday these will all be household names. Like, not,
well, maybe not all of us, but
not necessarily like household names. But his point was these kids are going to go do something cool. Which,
yeah, he knew.
Yeah. Which was neat, because I look at everybody on that roster and I'm just like, oh, they're amazing. Well, they were amazing back then. So it was it's no stretch of the imagination that they would go on and do something.
Right. It wasn't like
looking at your website. It's interesting that you have your blog archive on there and it goes back to 2005. Like, I rarely
does it.
See
no,
that,
don't go there.
That's amazing. Like 17 posts from 2005. I would love to read the blog post that I was doing in 2005. I wish I would have kept all, because I had different websites with blogs and stuff like that. But this is fantastic. It's every year, pretty much. A couple years skipped here and there, but it looks like you can tell probably you get when you have big life events, because there's like a gap.
And then it comes.
This is RiemannMyth.blogspot.com. Is that what you're on?
I'm just on the regular website.
Oh
yeah, there's a felix.blogspot.com, but I got to be more professional about this. I'm so like, I don't really pay attention to the internet anymore too much because I got kids and I'm like a different person now. And but one of the reasons I wanted to keep all my archives is because, well, working on the Rima world has been such a long project. It feels weird to cut off the older stuff as if it never happened, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in sharing your process as much as possible, because I mean, finding out how to do this professionally is just so difficult. And there's not that much information out there, because the landscape of graphic novels is ever changing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I kind of figure the more openness and information you can lay out there, probably the more helpful it will be for the younger generations coming up who are looking for information. Oh, how did this person do it? You know? There's probably only one or two people that actually went back and looked. One of them's name is Lee White, but like,
of course.
Also, I don't know where to put those things. I guess I could copy and paste them onto a document and save it for posterity, but I don't know.
I think it's cool.
Blogger makes it easy.
Yeah.
It is interesting to see though, that how long these things take when you walk into a bookstore or a library, to think that every book pretty much has that story. Like, took years, you know what I mean? It makes you appreciate it in sort of a different way.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate because Kazoo's career has been very successful, relatively speaking, and so he would let me tag along at Comic-Con back when they had it in person, you know, and they'd have the dinners and stuff afterwards for the publishers, and I got to meet so many writers and authors. So I had just so much research in my head before I sat down to start writing, and almost 100% everybody was like, yeah, it takes 10 years. Cause I'm like, oh, I've been working on my novel for a whole year now. I think I'm almost done. And they just look at me with this haunted look in their eyes. They're like, no, it takes 10 years. You know, I'm like, yeah, I'll show them, you know? Yeah. 10 years later, it does awesome. Take forever.
I'm curious. You mentioned you're a mom, you have two kids, and they're, what are they, ages 12 and 8?
Nine.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty good.
So the last 12 years you've been a parent. How does essentially a stay-at-home mom
being a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, because we do have listeners who are in that same boat. They've got kids at home. They're creative. They want to do comics, or they want to write, or they want to illustrate. Like, what would your, I'm just curious about that perspective from where you're sitting. What would your advice be? How do you make that work? How did you do a book while shuttling kids to school and dentist appointments and packing lunches and all that stuff?
I have one word for you. It's grandma.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, you know, I mean, not just my mom, but my mom had a huge part, especially early on when my first child was a baby and I was a new mother and I didn't know what I was doing. And I had that conflicting feeling where like, I shouldn't be quote unquote wasting my time watching my baby crawl around the floor. I should be working. Cause it's just how we're trained, I guess, throughout college. Mm-hmm. I'm totally different now, by the way. Now I'm just like, what am I doing working? I should be spending time with the kids, you know? Right. It's the best job in the world to be a mom. I love it. But, you know, I just got really good at being able to turn on and off the creative faucet, I like to say, mm-hmm. you know, and one of the reasons I stuck with a book like Rima is because the memory of that story and my love for that world is so powerful. I don't need to sit there and have a special surrounding to plug into it. I'm there. I just kind of mm-hmm. have to take a breath, close my eyes, and I'm there, you know, and, mm-hmm. and the urgency of wanting to get back to telling their story is so strong. And it has been consistent throughout the years that like, I don't need to, you know, get myself ramped up to like get into it. Yeah. So if you have a story like that, it really helps. If I'm trying to do a story where I'm trying to shape it around a publisher's needs, like where let's say, oh, we're looking for a book with a, you know, has like a little girl and a dragon or something, you know, like mm-hmm. It's so much harder. It's hard to get myself interested in doing something like that. But if it's something right. I'm doing to express something deep inside, then, you know, it's easy. So I work on the kitchen counter, you know, in the little cracks mm-hmm. of time, and I rearrange things. So for example, inking doesn't take as much brain attention as mm-hmm. doing roughs where you have to actually act out the emotions and think about the page turns and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have to be as mentally present. So I would prepare a bunch of pencils the night before, and then I would mm-hmm. have a stack of inks to work on while helping the kids with their homework or while they're watching TV and I'm keeping them company, you know?
Yeah. So you sort of planned it around like which activity takes the mental work and then which activity can I do sort of brainless and then yeah. kind of organize them into blocks kind of. And when you had that time, you'd kind of fit it in.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know how you like sit there and you're like coloring something and you're listening to a podcast. Well, instead yeah. of listening to a podcast, I'd be listening to my children chatter to me about uh-huh. My Little Pony or something. It's the same
idea.
You
can comment, you can talk back to them because you're, essentially, like Mike Mignola once said, inking's like eating peanuts. Like you just pop them in your mouth. It's like, you don't have to think yeah. about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some inkists would probably take offense to that, but for the most part.
Yeah, you know, piano players at the bar, they're not like sitting there looking at their fingers as they're playing the piano. They're talking to people here and there and stuff, yeah. you know. It's like that inking. I mean, if you're beginning, it's not like that. If you're a beginner, it's like you have to really focus hard and be like, oh, where does the line weight go and stuff. But once you get good enough where you don't have to think about that so much anymore, you can get to the phase where you're eating peanuts. Yes.
is what we're holding in our hands, this Rima book, is it like, did you redo the webcomic, or are you re-seeing pages from the webcomic now colored in this book, or is it a complete rehash or a revision of it?
The book is a direct adaptation of the novel that I wrote. Uh-huh. And I mean, there's so much to the development of Rima. I keep expanding on these things. But so when I did the novel and I tried to get it published, it just kept getting turned down because the story at the time was young adult, you know. Mm-hmm. But the way I wrote was like middle grade. So I kept yeah. getting the feedback like, oh, I'd like to work with you, you know, from editors, we'd like to work with you on the novel, but you need to take out the love story and make it just about friendship. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, oh, heck no, I can't do that. You know, like the whole love story is like the core of the whole, it's like taking the ring out of Lord of the Rings, you know, yeah. All the events kind of center around this love story that's developing. And I was just like, there's no way. So I was like, well, I guess I better just give up and put it online, you know? Mm-hmm. So I guess it's just going to be a hobby. It's just for myself, you know? Mm-hmm. So I did an online novel, and I mean, that was really interesting too. I could go on for a while about, there's like a whole world of like people that just exclusively do novels, serializing yeah. their novels online. Yeah. I didn't even know that was a thing.
And at some point they'll actually like publish on Amazon, just self-publish on there and sell it that way. And
some people are doing really well with that too. I mean, their tenacity was really inspiring. But yeah, this book is an adaptation of that novel. And there's elements of the webcomic in there.
Okay.
So I think people who are fans of the webcomic will recognize certain scenes and be like, oh yeah, I remember that. And actually, some people who have already read the advanced reader copy, they said that I remember seeing that in the webcomic, even if it wasn't there, literally, it's just the feel of it is still there. It still feels like the way the webcomic feels. And it's the same characters, the same world, but the events have been arranged in a more emotive and sensible way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to the publisher about putting this thing out, how much control over story did they have? And did you have to push back when they wanted to change some big element, like the love story that you're talking about or any other part of it? How much freedom did you have, or how much did you have to bend to what they kind of wanted it to be?
Well, I understand when you get published through a large publisher, they have their own needs and expectations, and based on their experience interacting with the readership and the buyers. So I know I'm going to have to compromise on some stuff, you know, but I just kind of told them, like, I had an outline of the whole entire series and I had the novel. So I sent that to them and they asked me, is it okay if we turn this into middle grade? Once I started doing pages, it looked like a middle grade comic book. So they're like, can it be middle grade? And I was like, as long as I don't have to change the basic storyline or take out any love story elements, I am okay with the label changing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as long as you guys don't change it at all.
Yeah. And they were just like, they're like, yeah, that's fine. You know, I think they just understood that I don't understand exactly that I am a middle grade author, even though in my mind, like, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like, why it's so broody and intense. They're just like, no, it's for kids. Right. Scholastic knows what they're doing. So I was just like, okay, I'll just trust them. I've seen them behind the scenes working with Kazoo over the years, and they're just excellent. So I mm-hmm. have a lot of faith in them as well, that particular team at Scholastic.
So I noticed here in the book, did you hand letter it as well?
Well, no, I had a, this was a big argument that Kazoo, well, I shouldn't say argument, it was a debate that Kazoo and I had, because I guess because I grew up reading a lot of manga, I don't care about font like at all. Uh-huh. And he's just more of a graphic designer mind. So he was just like, it's everything, Amy, you know, you got to have that, that font that fits the drawings and everything. And I'm like, whatever, nobody cares, you know? And so the font was the last thing I did. I just had this placeholder font. I think it was like Myriad Pro or something like that. Just uh-huh. some standard font. And I had to redraw all the bubbles once we got the handwritten font. The handwritten font was made through Scholastic.
Oh, okay. And it's based on your handwriting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. They did an excellent job. It has all the staggering options and stuff.
It looks so good. I think Kazoo's right. I'm siding well, on him.
But that opens up a question that I had here. You know, Kazoo's so good and you're so good and you guys know story so well. So did you guys have to make some kind of boundary where like you're drawing something and he kind of walks in, kind of looks over your shoulder and be like, eh, I'd go with a different perspective. And then you're like, shut up. That's the right perspective. Like, I mean, cause that kind of, does that come up? I mean, you're both so good, but you obviously come at it from your own angle. So do you have to say, hey, I'll ask for feedback when I want it? Or do you guys constantly work together and critique each other's work?
Well, yeah, in the past it was more like that. When we first got together, we were always like in each other's stuff and like trying to quote unquote help out. It was not helpful. It would just derail us like equally on both ends. So we're just like, now, you know, we've been together for about 15 years now and we're just kind of like know each other so well. So I would just look at things and I think to myself, I'm like, is this the kind of thing that's going to send him down a rabbit hole? Yes. If the answer is yes, he's probably hasn't reached the conclusion yet. So I just better step back to give him space to figure it out, you know, and mm-hmm. he does the same for me. But I think Kazoo can't help himself sometimes. If he sees something, he's just got to say it. Mm-hmm. Drives me crazy. He's not here to defend himself, though, so I won't get too into it.
So you have to learn what you're going to take and what you're going to just leave on the floor, essentially.
Oh, with Kazoo in particular?
Yeah, just with advice and whatnot, right?
Which battle to fight?
Yeah, you have to pick and choose. And working with my editor at Scholastic, she's been excellent. She's been there for a while now, and she's gotten really good at understanding how to work with artists, I think, in particular, mm-hmm. and understanding their journey to get there. I wrote for book two, I wrote a script, the entire script for book two first. So Cassandra Helen Fulton, my editor, had a chance to go through and edit that first before I drew anything. Mm. Just super helpful in terms of process. I know that's not the way everybody wants to or can work. Mm-hmm. Like Kazoo, for example, he doesn't like scripts at all. He's more of like, he likes to make a creative mess and then pick out the best parts and then assemble it. And I can't work like that either. So we're very different in that regard. But it was helpful to do the script for editorial sake. So, but yeah, there was a lot of back and forth with that.
A little bit more on process. So are the comic pages balloonless and like without the balloons, and then you add that all digitally, or were you having to like Photoshop and resize each thing?
Well, typically I just do it. When I sit down to start a page, I think about the layout, right? I think about the story moment. And once I have the layout and the story moment working together, then I fill in the balloons first. I do the dialogue first. Yes.
Are you digital or traditional at this stage?
When I'm roughing out stuff, I do it with a pen, a ballpoint pen on a piece of paper.
Okay.
Actual paper. Yeah. Cool. I can't do digital at that phase for some reason.
And what size
it's just
are,
my age, I think.
What size are layouts?
They are half of a sketchbook, pretty much 1-to-1, because I want to be able to see, it's pretty much this size. I want to be able to see that it's going to be readable at this size, you know?
Gotcha. Yeah.
Especially for kids with vision problems and whatnot. So I do it as close to final size as possible. And, I always start with the balloons before I start drawing figures, just because I know that, you know, as a reader, my experience of reading a comic book is always it goes straight to the word balloon. And I think that's most people. So as long as the word balloons are good, then the drawings kind of add just the color out of the peripheral of your vision as you're reading.
Yeah.
And of course, you go back and stop and look at it longer once you're done reading the story. But, you know, no one's sitting there and like looking at the picture first and then reading. Or maybe people are.
Are you serious? Do you do that? Can you look at the picture?
I get exhausted looking at like French comics because I'm just looking at that art and I'm like, how did they have time to do this for a comic page? Like, but I had a friend tell me once, she's like, I read this graphic novel. I forgot to look at all the images. I just read the words. And I'm like, why even read a graphic novel if you're not looking at the art? So I'm more of an art person on that front.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I mean, the French comics you were mentioning, they definitely emphasize art more than story in my point of view. I could be wrong, but it just felt like, I feel like if your art is over rendered and too beautiful and too much of a distraction from the story, it kind of hurts the pace of the reading to me, you know, like I don't want the drawings to look too good to be a distraction. You know?
I'll agree with you there.
I'm going to start saying that for all my books. I don't want the drawing to be too good. So
I just don't want to distract from the story.
Yeah. The story's king. I don't want to distract. It works for certain things, but I think when you're trying to tell an actual story with like character feelings and stuff, like you don't want to, like if someone's crying in a panel because something really traumatic just happened, you don't want to sit there and be like, look at the way they rendered those tears and the wrinkles in their face as they scrunch up their nose. Like, you don't want to, you just want to be like, oh, they're so sad. That's the only emotion you need to hear, you know? So I'm kind of like, I got to be careful. Sometimes I tend to go too detailed in certain things. Like I want to draw all the roof tiles and stuff. And I'm like, no,
oh, yeah.
I must
every
not.
Leaf.
Yeah. I'm just like, stop drawing leaves.
That's cool. So then once those layouts are done, how do you actually do a page? Is it digital at all in the drawing inking stage, or is it just digital in the coloring stage?
Just coloring. I ink using a pencil, and this is a method that Kazoo and I kind of developed over the years together, like ping-ponging back and forth. Like, so one missing piece of the story of my career is this series I did for a now collapsed publisher called Tokyo Pop, who was very controversial at the time. But that was my first real bigger publishing job. And that was a 2-book series of graphic novels called Sorcerers and Secretaries. It was like this sort of romantic comedy that took place in New York City. And it was just my lovely letter to New York and to that age of being in your early 20s. I had to get really fast because I took deadlines seriously back then. I don't really anymore. I'm just like, yeah, I guess I could get it done. But then, you know, the work is going to suffer, which is so true. When I try to hit deadlines, the work really suffers. And then maybe you could sell the book for like a year, but then nobody's going to want to read it 5 years from now because it's so rushed through, you know? So I'm a big believer in having soft deadlines, like, you know, a ballpark thing to aim at, but nothing. You shouldn't use it as a deadline. But I did back then. So I had to get good at doing things really quickly. And one of those things was ink using a pencil, to have print out layouts in blue line, and to have a script format that was easy for me to translate into thumbnails. And I'm still using the same methods today. So Kazoo and I both ink with 2B pencils to save our hands from draining too much with the inks. You know how when you're hold a mechanical pen. Yeah. You can grip too much. And we're like in our 40s now. And we're like feeling the achy joints coming in, and we're just like, we got to chill it out. So that's why we use a soft pencil to ink. And cause you could just up the contrast in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do so much with digital tools now. But yeah, so once I'm done with layouts, I scan those in, and there's an adjustment. That's where I do a lot of editing, you know, and I redraw stuff digitally on Photoshop. Mm-hmm. And then when it's all looking good, I print it out in light blue ink, and then on a Bristol board. And then I do the pencil thing. The borders and all the word balloons are done with a Micron, so it has that solid black mechanical feel. And then the drawings of the characters and the backgrounds are all with the pencil. I scan that back in, turn it into line work, and then I start coloring, which is a whole other discussion. But yeah.
Right. Well, I see you've got color assistants and then a flatter as well. So essentially the flatter, they are doing the first pass of, we're just laying in color. They're not picking colors necessarily, right? And then what are you handing over to assistants?
Well, Emmy Toyonaga, the assistant colorist for Rima Book One, she came in like in the second half of the book. Because it was starting to get like, oh, we got to go a little faster, you know? And I was like, this coloring process is taking forever. Yeah, it takes forever coloring. And so I was trying to think of a way to split it up. And so far in book two, I'm not in need of another coloring assistant, just my flatter, Audra Furuichi, she is so amazing. Man, I could sing her praises all day. Well, I'm getting off track anyway, but I split it up into cast shadows, and then I would go on to do the lighting, final lighting and rendering, like the mood lighting, you know,
because
the
mood.
So anything that sort of would need a director's eye, I would come in for that. And anything that could kind of be done mechanically, I would give it to Emmy Toyonaga, you know, and that really helped speed things up quite a bit. But Audra's flats are, first let me mention, she's an amazing artist on her own. In fact, I think she's a better draftsperson than I am. Technically speaking, she's much better at drawing than I am. She does a web comic called, Nemu Nemu. That's what it's called. NEMU. And it's serialized in a Hawaiian newspaper. They live in Hawaii, and, she's been doing that for a long time. But I didn't know that she colored comics, and we were in Hawaii, and I was like dabbling with the idea of coloring my comic, you know, because I didn't want to color my comic at first. I didn't want to have anything to do. I was like, I'll just do line work. I don't have time. I'm a mom. I'm busy. You know, I can't color this whole thing. Right. And Kazoo also was behind me whispering, you should color your own comic, Amy. You got it in you. And I'm like, stop.
Just is he like an angel or a devil?
He's pushing you to these things.
he's the voice of unavoidable realities that you're not ready to accept or acknowledge. And it gets him into trouble. I see him doing it all the time to people, our friends and family. And I'm like, it's getting you into trouble. But sometimes you got to hear the hard truth, right? And he was right. he's almost always right. And especially in this case, he was right about, I should be coloring it because it's such a special story to me. And only I know what it feels like to be there in my mind. You know, I can't really translate that to anybody with words. I have to just show them. So he was right about that. But Audra, she's somebody who seemed to really understand what I needed for the flats. So the way that she would separate the flats in the layers in Photoshop, it was almost eerie because I'd be like, oh my gosh, how did she know that I needed the branches, you know, to be on a layer on top of the leaves, you know? And she's just like, I just looked at the line work. It just, if I was coloring it, that's what I would do. And I was just like, yeah, she's just so amazing. And she's very organized. So she actually forced me to make like, she made it for book one, a Excel spreadsheet, you know, with all the pages and all the different phases. So she can
you're talking Jake's language now.
Yeah. He's like, I keep everything in my head, you know? So I'm just like, I'll just do it one page at a time. And Audra's like, no, if I'm going to be working ahead of you, I need to be organized. And so she really had a huge part in that. She also just sort of along the way, I call it visual copy editing. It's kind of like, I don't know if that's an actual term, but that's what it felt like to me, where she would be like inconsistencies in the costumes. She would make sure to make a mark saying, oh, you forgot to draw the ring here. You forgot to draw the pattern on Philip's hem here, you know? And you would think it doesn't matter, but once I implemented all her changes, it like makes it seem so much more professional, you know, and consistent. So she's just had such more than a flatter for sure, but I don't know what to call that role that she plays. She's just amazing. And I'm so grateful she's willing to do this with me.
That's cool.
Yeah. She's awesome.
Cool. Wow. I think you've exhausted all of the questions I've had about this. This is cool. Lee, did you have anything else you wanted to?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So maybe we can add this. We might take this out. It just depends. This is because it's such a stupid question.
Oh boy. Here we go.
No such thing as a stupid question.
Yeah, you know Lee.
No, I'll tell you how stupid my mind works. When you're saying like, who's your flatter and you're talking about that, I'm thinking I could use a flatterer. And that's just somebody that sits in the back of the room and gives me compliments. So that's kind of how. That is so stupid.
That wasn't a question.
I like that.
That wasn't a question. But I'm just telling you where I go. So,
a flatterer.
You know, you curate. It's so stupid. So you make these fantasy worlds and Kazoo does as well. And all this kind of magical scenes and all this stuff happens. If you could pick your own superpower, what would it be?
I think any superpower actually would be more of a curse than a benefit. So, cause it's like, let's say you have invisibility powers and you're tempted to like spy on people. You don't want to know. You don't actually want to know what they're saying about you. You know, right. It's like ignorance is bliss, man. You don't want to know. I'm not sure.
Portals.
What would you do?
I see portals in your work. Like, could you transport yourself to different things? I don't know. My son talks, the topic of portals comes up all the time. My son's 11. And it's just amazing how many portals come up. So I think I would be the creator of portals where you can just kind of travel to this thing. Like if I want to go snowboarding, I can just make a portal and I'm on the mountain and then I come back through the portal. So that would be my
You just land in the living room with all the snow coming, spilling in. Like, hey guys, take off your shades. Just came back from the mountain. What's going on?
I don't know. Superhero guy. What would yours be?
Yeah. I mean, guess I get frustrated by having to sleep.
Yeah. There you go.
I wish I didn't need to sleep so much. Oh, you know what a good superhero power would be? Never to have arthritis. That would be good. It's coming. I can feel it coming.
No, that's a real invincibility topic, though. Do you do anything to counterbalance that stuff that's starting to happen with putting so many hours into this as Jake has, as I have? You start to feel this. Oh, my back's hurting. Oh, my arm's hurting. My wrist. Do you do any exercises? Is there any kind of physical therapy things you're doing to counter that or to prevent that?
I mean, they're not physical therapy exercises. It's more like old lady stuff. Like, you know, I make sure to have hobbies outside of it. So my mobility is like constantly being used, you know, like I don't let myself get stuck doing just one motion over and over again. So my mother, growing up, she was a seamstress at a factory, a sewing factory. And one of her complaints always is the pain of her ankle from pressing down repeatedly on the sewing machine, and then of her elbow from pushing it, you know, pushing the cloth through the needle. And she did that so often for so many years that she started getting tennis elbow when she was like, I don't know, 36 or something like that. So she always warned me against that kind of stuff. So I only work 4 hours, maybe, when I'm working, only 4 hours. I do not let myself work more than that in one session. Otherwise it starts to hurt. And, I do a lot of exercise. I have a little trampoline. What is it called? A rebounder in our house. Dude, that thing is awesome. Everyone should, who's an artist, should have a rebounder. Not only is it good for your joints, but it makes you feel really good. Like a little kid. So when I watch TV and stuff, I'm just jumping up and down. And of course, diet. I could go on forever. Diet, I'm really into like finding health through eating right and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Well, no, it's good stuff though, because one of the things that we've been hitting on our podcast and the interviews and stuff is that it's not just about the work, but it's sort of about leading the life of an artist. And this stuff comes into play, I think, you know, like having hobbies outside of art, eating, you know, what you eat and how you feel the whole time. And it's just kind of the pattern of your life. So I'd like to hear about stuff like that.
Yeah. My best drawings come out when I'm at peak health, you know, after I've been like going to the gym for an hour a day and like those kinds of, and I'm not doing that right now. I'm just, I just do maybe 10 minutes of hard cycling in the morning, you know, just to get my blood flowing. And that's usually enough. And then some light weights, you know, and things like, I can't believe I'm talking about this.
So no, you're serious. You've got a whole gym.
Because, okay, so this story I've been working, it's going to sound so corny, but it's one of my life goals. Like if I die and as my last thought, whatever it may be, is one of them is like, I never got to tell Rima. I feel like I'm cursed to come back and do it all over again. That's how I honestly feel. It's so important to me to get this story finished and out there. I think because it helped me so much during such a difficult time in my life, I just know chances are it's going to help somebody out there who is going through something similar. You know, it was just healthy for me to have like this sort of escape where I could examine the problems I was going through, but in a safe environment, you know? So it's more than just, I want to just really tell a story. It's my favorite place to work in, which is also true, but I also understand the utility of it. And so all the stuff I do, my lifestyle choices, I need to do them so that I can actually finish the thing, you know, especially now that I'm getting older. So I'm like, I don't mind. Like a lot of times it's like, I think of comics almost as like a monk's practice, you know, you gotta it's a very meditative exercise. And you have to kind of treat it that way. So I'm like, make sure that, you know, I'm not eating too much sugar so I don't inflame my joints and like
plenty of sleep the night before.
Yes. Got to sleep, make sure I'm in a good mental state and I'm not stressed out and trying to absorb all the chaos, especially nowadays it's happening everywhere. If you're too busy trying to solve the world's problems, you won't be able to do what you're good at, you know? And if you're an artist, I think one of the best gifts we have is to give others a respite from all of that noise. Why would you want to increase the noise? You know, I mean, that's just my philosophy. So
that's anyway. Awesome.
That's awesome. Perfect. That's a perfect way to end that. That's great.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is great.
Thank you both. It's so nice seeing you and talking to you, and I love your podcast.
Awesome. Thank you. Awesome. Good luck with the book. It's so exciting that this is going to come out the same day the book comes out.
I know. It's going to be really cool. I can't wait to promote it and let people know.
You know, I was talking to David Hone about the podcast and these interviews and stuff. And he's like, you know, what would be cool is when people have something that's coming out to interview them before it comes out. And then you know, like wait a year or 6 months, whatever, and then interview them again and see like, how did it go? And what did it feel like? And all that stuff. This would be a good follow-up later.
We should follow up. When's book two come out?
We don't have a solid date yet, so I'm not sure. I'm better off not really saying anything because it's probably going to get pushed back.
Let me ask you this. Where are you at with book two?
I'm about a third finished. So I have like about 100 pages. Well, I won't get into specifics, but I have quite a bit of it done and the script is all done. So that was the biggest one because the story is the hardest part. So I'm confident it'll be done soon.
Okay. Well, I hope we have you on before that because I know how you are with deadlines. So this book two.
Yeah, I don't care about deadlines. Awesome. I care about the story. I care about it being a good reading experience. So once it is, then I'll be ready.
That's awesome. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for joining us for this interview with Amy Kibuishi. We had such a good time with that. Learned so much about it. Go buy her book today. It is out today, The Rima Chronicles. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at bookstores. But go just type it into Google and search Rima Chronicles and bring that up. If you want to see more of Amy's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Amy Kibuishi. That's AmyKibuishi. Google to go see that blog that Lee was looking at. It goes back to 2005. I thought that was really cool. That was, what was that called? That was felax.blogspot.com. So it's felaxx.blogspot.com. I don't know if she wants us sharing that, but whatever. It's
out there.
It's on the front page of Google. All right. So let's see. 3-Point Perspective is brought to you by svslearn.com. We're becoming a great illustrator starts, and your hosts are Lee White, Will Terry, and me, Jake Parker. Again, Will couldn't join us this time, but he will be here next time. But if you want to find Will's work, it's willterry.com and at willterryart on Instagram. Lee White is leewhiteillustration.com and at leewhiteillo on Instagram. And my website is mrjakeparker.com and at jakeparker on Instagram. Podcast is produced by Daniel Tu. That's Daniel T-U, and you can find his work at daniel2.co. Special thanks to our SVS production manager, David Bro, who helps get things done over here at SVS Learn, and also Austin Shirtliff, who is essential to getting our stuff done here at SVS Learn. Thank you to Lily Camille for the show notes, and also thank you to our admin person, Lisa Fott, for all that she does as well. All right. Please share this episode around, share this podcast around. These things live and die by word of mouth. We love getting reviews on iTunes. We love seeing the tweets and the Instagram posts about the podcast. Thank you very much for everybody who does that. And lastly, go draw something.